And I'll talk to you guys hopefully next week. Bye.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3.
In the next hour, we will cover topics and news related to visual digital arts in all its forms. Welcome to Digital Sites. We air every first Thursday of every month here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Stay tuned.
For many of us, technology appears to be an impenetrable black box. In this episode of Five Perspectives, we will look at how technology informs storytelling and vice versa. How as artists and creators, we can use technology as a tool to push our artistic practice further. I'm Cheryl Sim, Managing Director and Curator of the Five Foundation, and I'm your host for this Five Perspectives episode on the balance between technology and storytelling. At the New Storytellers Conference, Ted Shilowitz, futurist at Paramount Pictures, talks about the one trait that differentiates us from all other living things, and how contemporary technology is there to serve this trait.
There's literally one thing that human beings, us in this room, Homo sapiens, can do that, to our knowledge, no other species on planet Earth can do. Anybody want to take a guess? I'll tell you. Say that again.
Tell stories.
Tell stories. That's the answer. Stand up, take a bow. It's harder to get to that answer than you might realize. There is literally one thing that we do that nothing else on planet Earth that lives or sentient beings can do is create and tell stories, create fiction. This is a fiction. Think about what we're doing right now. We've all gathered in this place. This is not real. It's artificial. Someone made this. Every single thing about this. Someone made the chairs, made the clothes you're wearing, made the fact that I have this microphone on and I'm standing here, and I've created a story dynamic here. Other animals can't do this. Imagine in this environment like this, there's other animals that are very close to us genetically. Like one little tweak of the DNA. Imagine if instead of 100 or so humans in here, there was 100 chimpanzees in here. And we asked all the chimpanzees, sit quietly in a little sloping arc and pay attention to this guy on the stage for an hour. Do you know what would happen? Chaos. You ever been to a sporting event? It's amazing that 90,000 people can sit in a giant thing and not kill each other almost all the time. Every once in a while, we turn into other things, a story, and technology quite robustly. Pixar, to me, is the one entity that you can point to that really, really, really gets it. They put story where it belongs, main attraction. They put technology where it belongs, in the supporting cast. I have a very strong belief that when technology outpaces story or tries to, things go off the rails. It does not connect to the human experience. It just connects to the technology experience. So, what we say, or at least what I say about technology, is it needs to be in a supporting role. As we say in our world of movies, we say, just happy to be nominated. That's it. And the reason I define Pixar as the one is because out of any entity where you look at like a whole breadth of motion picture equation, these guys know how to make you cry better than anybody I've ever seen. They know how to pull your heartstrings. And I rate the success of Pixar movies simply by how many times it makes you cry. Like, Up is the big one because I got 6 full cries, like full on, right? They understand story and they use amazing technology to get you there. So just as you think about it, I'd say think about it.
The rapid evolution of technology requires us to rethink and evolve the many ways we now tell stories. Resh Sidhu, creative director at AKQA, illustrates the trajectory of storytelling from its early applications to the use of immersive technology where the audience becomes the actor inside the story.
We have entered an era where VR is fundamentally changing the way we think about storytelling. And all of these projects and all of these experiences, it's important to understand how they are progressing the medium forward. We've shifted from linear storytelling to non-linear narratives. But as VR continues to evolve, I constantly ask myself the question, how do you tell stories in VR? What does that even mean? And I've begun to think very deeply about the notion of storytelling, so deeply it takes me back to the beginning of storytelling. Storytelling started way back in the early caveman times, and it was really a way for us to make sense of the world. It's part of what makes us human, to tell stories. As Sandra said, I'm a parent. I tell stories to my sons when they were small, and I've been telling stories to them throughout their life as they've grown up. It's a way we make sense of the world. It's not that just that they get us from A to B. They help us. They help entertain us. They help us live. And eventually, those early tribal stories migrated into myths. And what we now know from myths and religions and from rituals and myths to now religion. But something happened in the 15th century that changed that, and that was the arrival of the printing press. So what changed? Well, what changed was that the notion of storytelling began to become controlled. It became controlled by the writer. The author controlled the story he wanted to tell you. And as we came into cinema and theater, the artists, the performers control the story that they want you to hear. Right now, I feel like we are in an era of disruption. And it's exciting. VR and mixed reality is disrupting that storytelling process again. Because now you are the camera and you can decide on the story you want to take in. We've moved away from linear storytelling into this spherical space. It takes time to understand how to create new stories in a new medium. And I always love playing this film. This is George Millet's Trip to the Moon, because I think we can take so many learnings from early cinema. The story of cinema's first steps provide a number of important takeaways. Back then, similar to us, filmmakers were limited by the technical constraints. But it didn't stop George Millet from sending his audience to the moon. 5 years prior to this film, the first cinema movie, I don't even want to call it a movie, the first cinema piece was played in a theater similar to this, to an audience similar to you. It was the arrival of the train. It was literally a train coming into the platform. Every single one of the audience members got up and ran out the theater, because they believed that that train was going to hit them in the face. Can you imagine 5 years later, Millet was imagining a trip to the moon? This is the power of storytelling and imagination. And this is where we are in VR. We haven't even reached, we are only in year 5. It took 10 years, a decade, from this film to get to the first full feature-length film, Citizen Kane. I'm excited for who's going to make the first VR Citizen Kane, and what that language and what that experience is going to feel like.
Kevin Slavin, director of the MIT Media Lab, visits an early study by Jakob von Uxgull to see how artists look to scientists and scientists look to artists to find the different ways that one can understand the world.
This is Germany in 1934. Jakob von Uxgull And Uxkull introduces this term called Umwelt. And the Umwelt describes the subjective world of the organism, right? That the experience of the world that the swordfish has is dictated in part by the apparatus that it has to perceive it. Same thing for me, same thing for a tick, and so on and so forth. And so what he did, and it was really, it's trippy what Uxkull did. It's 1934, and he's like doing drawings of like, this is how the environment and the umwelt of the honeybee. So this is the environment, which is to say, you know, objectively, this is what's there. But for the honeybee, this is the world as it is perceived. And so some of them he did as drawings, but the really trippy stuff is he's like, it's, you know, 1934, and he's like, I've been studying the eyes of flies and a bunch of things. So he started taking photographs and then using manipulations of the printing plates around what he understood to be happening in the eyes of the fly. And then when that wasn't enough, he started drawing with watercolor over it, all in order to try to answer in some way for himself and for the very few people who paid attention to his work at the time, what are these other planets that run parallel to ours? And so Uxkull says, here's the chandelier seen by the man, and here it is, as best I can tell, as it would be seen by a fly. And he's studying living systems, but he's basically making paintings. And for all this work, they made his office a cigarette store in an aquarium, which is just shows you that being an academic was always awful. And by the way, it's worth thinking about what provoked these ideas with Uxkull. What provoked even this approach with Uxkull? And, who knows? But what I would say, based on where and when he was around and the people that he was working around, he was probably pretty interested in the work that was very fashionable and new, that was like, you know, had its own conferences just like these, where everybody was like, hey, have you guys heard about cubism? Have you heard about futurism? Have you heard about Eurypittura? Right? Like, and so I think that this is one of those moments, one of those very important moments where artists look to scientists and scientists look to artists, because they both had the same question, which is, how do we understand the world? How do we understand the world?
Our access to technology is now unprecedented. And as an artist, Don Hahn, a major actor in the Disney Renaissance of the 1990s, found any technological means available to him to be a painter, a filmmaker, a storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think we should all paint. It's just impossible and wonderful to be a painter. And I use my iPad only. I have an iPad Pro and I use Procreate. I don't use a stylus. I just use my finger. And I just love it. And to me, filmmaking is like painting, and like everything I do in life is like painting. What's amazing right now is a lot of my documentaries I shoot on Canon 5Ds, and the entry level to shooting a documentary and editing it is really low now. You can shoot an entire film. There was one at Sundance last year on your cell phone, and you can even cut it and score it on your cell phone if your fingers were small enough. The ability to enter that world and make a film, and animation is the same way. You know, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying the technology is easy. And I'm not trying to diminish at all the art of technology that goes into making those movies. But when you can make it transparent, I mean, that's the weird thing about animation or filmmaking. It's impossible and hard and grueling and chaotic, with a goal of getting rid of all that and suspending your disbelief long enough to get captured in this story about what it is to be human. So, you know, you all know how painful it is to be an artist or just do what you do during the day for a living. And yet in filmmaking, the goal is to make the audience forget that.
Technology is the means through which artistic expression can be articulated. The symbiosis between art and technology is the subject of Phi's great quest. Thank you for listening to Phi Perspectives.
When you have a new project going, what motivates you? You talked about getting people more aware. What gets you driving still?
I think it's a good question. I start always as a storyteller and a filmmaker with how I want the participant to feel. That is a driving force of what mm-hmm. I'm doing. And I'd say I'm a multidisciplinary filmmaker because I'm not faithful to like any specific discipline. So I look at the story, I look at the emotion, and then I move back from that premise. And then I go through a journey, and then that will take me to the technology. Mm-hmm. So with Riot, I wanted to reveal to people how you would respond in a riot situation.
Right.
And how you might respond is not how you think you would respond. Like, I may think I'm the person like, hey, let's take on the police, but maybe I'm really hiding behind the car petrified. So I wanted to really show people. So a technology that could reveal to you who you are was facial recognition and right. artificial intelligence.
But using facial recognition is quite, you know, unusual in an artistic setting. So I'm guessing the technical feat. What about you? Is it something that gets you driving when you start a new project?
Technology, I mean, to a degree, but I think high level, I mean, the National Film Board, ONF, as Karen said, generally it's story first.
Generally,
I mean, I think I would be lying if I said we never looked at a piece of technology and said, what are its affordances? What do we think it as a means of communication, as a tool for the artists that we work with? What can it do? So we don't start there, but I would say that we also don't ignore it. But generally, it's sort of what is it we want to say about the world. A lot of what I do, a lot of what our studio does, is on the creative nonfiction side. Mm-hmm. So the focus there is on point of view storytelling. What do we want to say about the world, the artists that we're working with, the teams that are supporting them?
Also, how do you get the audience involved? So it's about what you want to say, but it's how you want the audience to perceive what you want to say. Does VR help in getting the audience at the center of the storytelling? I mean, is that the main focus with that technology?
It's not for sure that with VR or 360 storytelling that the person will be at the center. Some people say that when they put on the very act of putting on a headset
right.
puts the user at the center, and I don't quite agree. I think that you can, depending on how you design and the story you're telling, you can put that user, make them a ghost, make them an observer. They can be just as distant as you might be when you're watching a film.
A film, yeah.
So it depends. I mean, I think for me, Riot was an example where I'm very much at the center, even though I'm not wearing a headset. There's no, it's not 360 or virtual reality, but it's very much the audience member is at the center.
So to answer your question, I would say not exclusively, no, because I don't use VR. I create an experience where, as opposed to going into a world, the world is reflected around you. Mm-hmm. And I deliberately created that because through my experiences, your emotions will affect the narrative of the film. And I want to show the participants in the exact same way their emotions affect the narrative of their reality. So if you respond angrily to a riot cop, he will elicit a different response than if you he may elicit a different response if you're calm. And the same way that maybe if you go home and you have an argument with your partner or your flatmate, if you respond calm as opposed to angry, you may elicit a different response. So deliberately, I don't want to put you in this like consciously artificial state. Mm-hmm. I want to put you in a state to show you that there's no imperceptible technology. The webcam is monitoring you, but you haven't got any technology on you. So that when you walk away, you're like, oh, you're interacting with your life in the exact same way.
So what's your philosophy about technology then behind it all? Mm-hmm. Do you feel that the machine mm-hmm. can help us know each other better?
My objective with technology is to use it to help humanize us more, bring humanity back into our lives, as opposed to I find that technology often can isolate us and separate us from other people. Like if something's really dramatic happening on the underground, as opposed to helping people are quite commonly just videoing it. Mm-hmm. You know, our sense of humanity is slowly being eradicated with becoming this observer, because it's kind of like a separator of what's happening. I'm like, okay, let's use technology to evoke more of our humanity. So I'm kind of inverting the use of technology as an artist.
Wow, so to bring out more humanity.
Yeah, absolutely, and to give you a greater understanding of yourself and be a mirror back to yourself as opposed to somewhere to hide on your iPhone all the time.
Does technology help your art make emotions come out even more? I mean, is that a way for you to tap into that even better?
technology is the main communication tool through which people communicate. Mm-hmm. So if I'm an artist in this current age creating work, if I don't use technology, I am going to be isolating a huge aspect of my potential audience, particularly young people. If I go and paint and use sculpture, that's going to be a certain demographic. So it is the language that
Is that something you think about?
I'm 100% conscious of that as an artist. I'm 100% deliberate in every single thing I'm doing. If I want to reach people with a particular message, there's no point creating a sculpture if I want to reach 18 to 24-year-olds. How are they going to connect? How will it resonate with them? Mm-hmm. So these are deliberate decisions I make in every single area of my craft. So that's the language I have to use in this current age. And I think the word you're looking for was, I use emotions to navigate the experiences so that it's like their emotions are the remote control. So subconsciously, you are navigating through this world and that you can go back into my experiences again and navigate through it in a different way and see how your emotions can elicit a different narrative.
Mm-hmm. You know, every tool, every medium has its affordances. I mean, I do agree in the sense that technology can, and specifically we're talking with Draw Me Close about essentially what is a play, an immersive play. It's a one-on-one experience between an audience member and an actor that uses virtual reality technology. So the audience member is wearing a virtual reality headset. The artist at the core of it, Jordan Tannehill, very much wanted to create something that both said something about the world, but that was also emotional and had a dramatic arc to it. That particular medium, that those particular set of technologies has some affordances. I think one of them with VR is its ability to physicalize things, to make you recognize and remember that you have a body.
Yeah.
And you can participate in an experience in that way. And in this case, it's something that connects both an analog or a physical world and a virtual, because it is a live performance, because it's theater.
Yeah, so it's somewhat familiar for
so
the audience.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing with technology, and especially VR and AR, not everybody in the general public has had the chance to actually experience it. And so I'm wondering, in an era where a lot of people have access to a lot of different types of technologies, is it hard as artists to leave a lasting impression, to impress the general public? Is it getting harder than it used to be? I mean, I don't know. And when there were less technology around, maybe people were more easily able to get into a story. Do you feel that there's a change in how the audience gets into a story or not?
So there's always going to be a place for linear film and traditional sculpture and art, but how this technology affects us psychologically and neurologically is completely different. There's been so much recent studies coming out, like young children as young as 8 years old cannot decipher the difference between memory and VR experiences.
Wow.
So how that's affecting us is completely different to the emotional impact of like a painting or a sculpture. So these are very, very, very powerful tools that we have at our disposal, and that's why I'm seeing people I'm meeting around the world very, very impactful reactions to our work, which are very short. They may be like 3, 8, 9 minutes, but the emotion that you're eliciting is
lasts
for a long time. Like I've done VR experiences or other media experiences for 3 minutes. I'm like, why am I crying after a 3-minute animation? I'd normally have to be watched a 90-minute film to get to this sense of emotionality. So we've got a very, very serious toolkit at our disposal. And the fact that it's in the hands of artists, I think, is a good thing, because on the whole, most people I meet who are artists have a sense of vision and integrity in what they're doing. Mm. So it's a good time to be working with these type of tools, and I believe they're in the hands of the right people.
We'll be right back. This is Robert Murdoch of the Mindshare Learning Report, Canada's learning and technology e-magazine. And happy Monday and welcome to This Week in Canadian EdTech special edition. I'm honored to have joined me past teacher, vice principal, and now publisher of Brainspace, Nikki Middleton, a veteran in augmented reality with 7 years of experience in publishing with AR. And she has a keen understanding of best practices when introducing this tech to students and young learners as publisher of Brainspace. And especially during this pandemic, they've pivoted and are thriving. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
Perhaps we can talk about what was the inspiration, first of all, behind Brainspace magazine.
Oh, my. So 7 years ago, I was a teacher and saw a TED Talk. I was fascinated with TED Talks. As a teacher, I was trying to get that sort of little bit of extra edge. And I saw a TED Talk presented by three young men that were then the owners and creators of Erasma, which I think was one of the original augmented reality platforms. And they were talking about the technology in the Harry Potter movie when the newspaper comes to life. And it was fascinating. And by the end of the TED Talk, I realized that it wasn't magic. It was something that was quite doable. It was something that a tech that was applicable. And so the wheels started turning. And by Monday, after I watched the TED Talk, I was on the phone with the three guys from Erasma in San Francisco saying, hey, I used to be in the magazine industry and I'm now a teacher and I saw your TED Talk and I'm wondering how we can somehow hybrid the two. And so they were very generous, extremely generous, and put up with what seemed like an impossible, crazy idea at the time. And that was in January. And by August of the same year, we launched the very first educational Erasma embedded magazine for kids. It was our first issue.
Amazing. Well, so perhaps you can give us a visual depiction and a quick demo of how it actually works. And,
sure. I'd love to.
I love props.
If I can do this backwards, let me see if
sure.
I can do this. So I'll just show you one of our covers. So quite simply, it's with a free app. So just in case anybody's wondering how this works. So I use an augmented reality platform. The platform I use now is called Zapper. There are many of them out there. So all you do quite simply is you launch the app, and then the print magazine comes in the mail. This is our print magazine. And then quite simply, I'll pull it back a bit here. Quite simply, you scan the cover. Oops, rescan.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Do that, but it comes to life.
Wow, that is so cool.
The covers are fun, but of course, the content on the inside is educational. And
pedagogically sound, that's one of the challenges I know a lot of startups have when they're passionate about education and they might be engineers or you know, techies, but they don't have that pedagogical expertise that we always talk about.
I think that's where we win, is there is a background within the educational arena. And then I learned tech and had experience in publishing as well. So all of them married beautifully to produce this magazine.
Talk to me about remote learning and how you pivoted. And I see the value in tactile learning, and there are many STEM companies that, and you have a vast array of content, and STEM is definitely a thing and your thing as well. You can talk about, and you know, STEM kids have been sent home, and you actually produce a print copy that goes to kids. And how frequently do you publish, by the way?
So we publish quarterly, and it takes a while, our small shop, to produce 40 pages
and
augmented reality.
It's intense. It's demanding.
Intense.
For sure.
Very demanding little publication. But in terms of remote learning, I think you hit it on the head when you were talking about tactile. As a teacher, I think you're introduced with digital. Digital is so important. And for me as a past teacher, I thought, yes, digital is important. We absolutely have to integrate it. But print is also, we don't have to have one with you without the other.
Right. And
so in can AR support remote learning? Absolutely, and it should, because the traditional curriculum can be delivered with AR. And, you know, it's funny because I often think a lot of the onus of augmented reality, creating the magic of augmented reality, is left to teachers. And I was once in the classroom, and
right.
all of my time and energy and hours were spent on the kiddos, making sure that they're getting what they need from the classroom. So, you know, there are these great tools to be accessed, but oftentimes it's a time restraint. It's a, I would love to learn, but really I'm overwhelmed. And I think AR, if it was used by big companies like the book publishers, like the textbook publishers, like the people who are responsible for developing curriculum,
right.
if they found a way to incorporate augmented reality into those textbooks, I think you'd have a different version of a better version of education for kids. And it's something that can take the theoretical on a page and make it very visual, very, as you can see, all of a sudden you scan a page. If you're struggling with a math concept or you're struggling with a science concept, you read the theory on a page and it can remain abstract unless you have a visual, unless you have a teacher. And the beauty of AR is that you can scan that page, have a visual demonstration of that concept. And then not only can the child have the visual, but he can pause. She can rewind and watch it again. She can chew on it a bit. She can right. walk away, come back, and look at it again.
So very three-dimensional and engaging.
Extremely engaging, very three-dimensional, and very much about learning at your own pace, which is extremely right. important these days, right? A lot of kids are having digital fatigue and getting
absolutely.
Anxious. And so it's really great that... And of course, I'm an evangelist for AR, but that we can marry this traditional with tech seamlessly, just to leverage what it is that we're trying to do so wonderfully.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that and articulating the value of augmented reality, because it's not very present that I've seen in classrooms. And when I think mm-hmm. about you know, the ability to leverage, you know, every student pretty much has a mobile phone these days or access to an iPad at home. And you don't have to have a smart board or a digital board like I have in my background. You can leverage the technology in your hand and the publication. So it's a hybrid learning kind of strategy that I think provides tremendous value. And I was one of those visual learners. So I would love to be back in school again, getting your magazine.
Oh gosh, me too. Yeah, there's so many beautiful things about it. And it's not dependent on Wi-Fi, which is a big problem right
now. Right.
Access through Wi-Fi is a problem in remote areas.
Sure, absolutely.
And technology, because it's static.
Right.
It's not dependent on Wi-Fi.
So and that addresses the equity piece for sure.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I recently experienced being turned into a hologram, which is a kind of other form of it. And it was really mind-boggling. And just, you know, appreciating the value and the concept of this, you know, hologram and being able to transport Star Trek, like, you know, high-profile experts in knowledge and you mentioned a zoo earlier in our conversation during our warm-up chat about the Toronto Zoo did an innovative. So this is a trend that's gaining a lot of traction, it appears.
It is. And, you know, the thing is, AR, like I listened to you talk about being transformed into a hologram and that magic and that excitement. And it's really what it is. And if we can bring that into learning, why wouldn't we? You know, it's just such a magical, incredible thing. And technology has the ability to do that, not in isolation, but, you know, with print, with textbooks, with things that are traditional, that are definitely something that are part of a teacher's roster. here we can bring that magic into it, and that excitement will translate to the kids, of course.
And that really is the secret sauce too, isn't it? When you're trying to engage kids, that I've spoken to many teachers who have struggled to get their kids excited about being a remote learner online. You know, if you're not using the flipped classroom, if you're not doing unique things like using STEM kits or augmented reality, it is going to be a challenge. So talk to me about your target audience and your subject matter.
So our target audience is children 8 to 14. And I say 8 to 14. When I was teaching, I was grades 2, 3. And there are 8-year-olds in there that are quite brilliant, that just hunger for more information. So that's why we made it 8. I would say 8 has to be a fairly savvy little 8-year-old. To 14, we're even carried in high schools. There are a lot of high schools that carry us. Because, of course, as with all education, it's a bit cyclical and it repeats itself. And some of those concepts come up again later. So I would say it has a shelf life for a lot of traditional academic environments. But 8 to 14 is our sweet spot, is really who we target.
And content-wise, what is your focus?
So for better or for worse, our content is everything. So we do touch on language, we touch on math, we touch on science. It's broad academic content. And I say for work because oftentimes that's a difficult package to sell. Most people want a math book or a science book because they can charge it out that way in terms of teachers to their departments. But no, we're broad. And when we first started out, we said we were doing this for kids. We're not core curriculum. We're very broad. So math, science, language, geography, history. We do botany, biology. We do it all. We do quite a bit. Yes.
Fantastic. So what's in store for 2021? Let's look into the crystal ball.
Yikes. What a question. So in general or just for Brightspace?
For Brightspace.
It's so hard to call. So we are pivoting. We're doing a lot of things. Like we've collected some of our content, and we're trying to create STEM, of course, STEM textbooks. We've partnered with a few. STEM Minds is one of our recent partners.
And local to you in Aurora. Yeah,
we are.
They do great
local
work.
Yes, they do. Thank you. Yes, they do. They do great work. Great woman. We're going back to very old snail mail systems where we're sending out circulation drives to a certain demographic. Grandparents love us. Grandparents absolutely love gifting Brainspace. So snail mail is good for them. Not a lot of them are on social platforms. So it takes, you know, thinking of, you know, what will we do to reach the masses that we wouldn't have done before.
Well, kudos to you for having the courage and the vision to continue this hybrid model.
Thank you.
Of traditional print and tech fused together and creating a dynamic and inspiring learning for kids at school and at home.
Yeah.
You're in many libraries and you're in many school libraries across North America and beyond. Perhaps you can share a little bit about your customer base, and you are award winning as well. So congratulations.
We are. Thank you. We've won a few awards stateside and in Canada. And we do publish, or we have a 40% of our subscriber base is in the US. And then we have the majority in Canada, but we're also in Hong Kong. We're in Australia. We're in England. We're in Italy. We're in Africa. We're in quite a few countries as well. So growing some legs there, trying to get some distribution in Hong Kong. We have a small distributor there. So again, that idea of pivoting and really trying to grow your audience outside the country is, it takes a lot of work. Yes.
Well, what a great EdTech success story. There are some 400 EdTech companies in Canada, we discovered, believe it or not.
There are a lot of us.
Fascinating.
Canadians are very innovative, yes.
Absolutely. Among probably the highest per capita of any country, I would say top three for sure. So for your magazine, how can they get a hold of it?
So easy to buy online, brainspacemagazine.com, and they can subscribe.
Perfect.
Yes.
Nikki Middleton, thank you so much for your time to get together today.
Thank you, Robert.
That was Nikki Middleton, Brainspace publisher in Newmarket, Ontario. My name is Robert Merdlanchi, the Mindshare Learning Report here at the Mindshare Workspace in Mississauga, Ontario. With that, until next time, stay healthy, stay safe, and keep the learning curve steep.
In many ways, is a year of profound shift for us all. The acceleration of certain futures predicted for the next 10 years is taking place right now in front of us. It was anticipated for a long time that all sorts of arts and culture would shift towards the digital form. In this Five Perspectives, we try to answer a simple but essential question. What do we do with all of our content? Jonas Mekas, legendary Lithuanian-American filmmaker, urges us to understand the medium before everything else.
Technology, it's out of my control. Same as cinema came in. I did not invent it. I just was born into it. And then the corporations, businessmen around the table with pencils and smoking, decided that video, we could make more money with video. What is this film business? And they decided to switch, to phase out film and go into video. So they term it, and I'm there, I'm their victim. You know, my film stocks disappeared suddenly. I have to relearn cinema by using different stocks. So I said, may as well. I try to see what I can do with video. But we have to do everything to preserve film as is and see film only as film and video to see video only as video. It's stupid to try to transfer it to film and destroy it, to destroy its very essence. It's like trying to transfer watercolors to oils or some crazy thing like that. That's stupid and absurd.
MIT professor William Euricchio asks the question of what to save and for whom. With the exponential creation and consumption of culture on the internet, Euricchio says that we have to learn to forget because we can't keep it all.
What to save and for whom? Crucial questions. And the what to save part is very complicated in the case of interactive documentaries. Digital culture in general. If you think about, I mean, right now we're above the 400 hours per minute of video uploaded to YouTube. That's like 67 years worth of video being uploaded per day. All of us are coming from a world of books and films and DVDs. That's in all of our background in this room, and maybe even for the people watching. And that means we're used to finitude. We're used to limits. We're used to a finite amount of material. There are only so many books, and it behooves us to try to keep them. But this level of productivity is unkeepable. It requires a new way of thinking, and we have to learn to forget. We have to learn to let go. So I'm not standing here saying the inherited notion we have from the advent of the book in the 15th century until now is something we have to stick with. We can't keep everything. We've got to be strategic about what we keep and what we don't keep. We have to be very creative about how to keep. But we can't keep it all, that's for sure. And so that's a problem. That's a paradigm shift that we have to reconcile ourselves with. Our inclination will be, and you'll hear this today, and I think it's right, the inclination is to save the best. To save the things that we do this with our DocuBase at MIT. We save projects that have been in competition, that have won awards, that have been noticed in some way or other. And that's crucially important. But as a historian, I can tell you, historians are a perverse lot. They always want what's not there. Almost every film historian I know is actually interested in the other stuff. So we have to find a way to keep both what our culture thinks is important, but also those things that could be important for a future that we don't see the importance of yet. Those hidden gems, those hidden insights that otherwise will be forgotten.
How do we keep important work accessible? Brett Gaylor, Canadian filmmaker, talks about the difficulties he faced to keep alive an interactive web platform for the marginalized and disenfranchised.
And so one of our challenges on a site like this was just hosting the videos, particularly in the early 2000s. It was so expensive to do this. And for us, just as a very small team that was building the site itself, and keeping track of all the formats and compression was way too much for our outreach teams to tackle, particularly in 2003, 2004. Video was actually kind of rare to be able to find on the web. And so I was involved with a community of very early video bloggers, as we called ourselves, and many of us gravitated to an early startup called Blip TV. And they were a nice, scrappy startup. We could talk to them. We knew them. And because they were inspired by what we were doing, they made an offer to us that we could have access to their professional services for free and use their API, which is an application programming interface, to have Homeless Nation automatically upload to their servers to host the video. Awesome. We could get back to doing our work. So years passed. Homeless Nation changed a lot of people's lives, and a lot of sort of moving stories like you just saw were told. And we peaked at about 5,000 registered users. And then this happened. The world changed. Part of the Homeless Nation project was bringing the internet into places like homeless shelters and squats. And when smartphones and Wi-Fi became really ubiquitous, suddenly the connectivity issues, at least in North America, where we were working, were less about the scarcity of the connectivity and the hardware. And of course, when Facebook became mainstream, that really made social networking accessible to everyone. Some of you may remember that moment when suddenly everyone you knew was on Facebook. Well, that happened with homeless people too. So it turned out that our project was actually hyper-relevant in the early 2000s and became less urgent as time went on. And in retrospect, this could have been a moment for us to think about whether the project was done. But we were busy, we were cash strapped, kind of hustling doc filmmakers. And what we did instead was raise kids, get jobs, teach at universities, and make more documentaries. And the site continued basically without our help. That community continued. Meanwhile, in some inbox that none of us actually were checking, we got these emails announcing that blip.tv had been sold. And they gave us a couple of months to get our videos up to the site, off of the site, after which time everything would be deleted. But none of us actually knew this was happening. It was being sold to Maker Studios, which are the force behind YouTube celebrities like this guy, PewDiePie, who has 50 million subscribers to his weird show about video games. And so one day we started getting messages in the inboxes that we did check that none of the videos could be found. They had disappeared. It was a pretty sick feeling in your stomach to get those emails. Not only something that you'd worked on for years, but more importantly, it was those voices that you saw earlier. Those voices just felt lost forever. And a lot of those people were no longer around. And as documentarians, it was crushing that these life stories had simply vanished. Now, luckily, I had a friend who worked at the Internet Archive, and I'd heard that they had some employees there who had created their own kind of activist archival team, and they call themselves rogue archivists, and they help rescue user data when websites go belly up. They kind of go in there and they suck up all the data. And it turns out that before BlipTV deleted their data, this team had downloaded all of the video files they could find before the plug was pulled. And after some back and forth, we're able to create a website for us, an archive of our archive where all these voices can be found today. And I do believe that they'll be there forever because the archive is an institution and a really important one. And that's why my first lesson is to give to them annually during their fundraising campaign. The second lesson I learned is really to partner wisely. While free was music to our ears, it wasn't smart to trust BlipTV with such an essential part of our project. This was a startup whose primary goal was to be sold. Right, so we should have investigated that and had a plan B in place. And finally, I've learned that as important as a plan to raise the money and make the thing is, the next most important producing question is to how to properly end of life this work. And so I was really happy to hear William's suggestion that when these things are being funded, what would it look like to have a little bit of money set aside for that? Just a quick coda on that story. A year after they deleted all of our videos, Maker Studios was bought by the Walt Disney Corporation, who laid off 80 people. So big double birds to Maker Studios, wherever you are.
All media art is glitch art. Obsolescence and extinction is the default digital condition. Rick Prillinger, archivist and professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, exposes the innate reality of digital artifacts, which is its state of ephemerality.
In the city where I live, San Francisco, artists are deeply fascinated with glitch, with breaks in the transmission chain, with flawed renderings, with mutilated picture and distorted sound, with ghosts in the machine, make it look ugly. Glitch replays a 20th century litany. Mimesis is futile. Beauty resides in its own destruction. Violence is inherent in the birth and in the movement of images. But to me, you know, glitch art fails to get one thing about itself, that all media art is glitch art. It doesn't last. Obsolescence and extinction are the default digital conditions, to paraphrase something Howard Besser said long, long time ago. Preservation is the greatest aberration. Preservation is the greatest glitch of all. Works are enclosed by their ephemerality. And digitality is funny. Somebody pranked this at Internet Archive. I didn't do this. Digitality is funny because while it introduces many new affordances, it shares many characteristics with older media forms. And one of the most striking characteristics of moving image works, both old and new, is that most of them, except for the few that are in long-term distribution, tend to suffer from enclosure. They find their way into archives and most don't find their way out again. Archival enclosure literally means that the record is sequestered from viewing and from use. It could be enclosed by copyright because it's unpreserved and delicate, by inaccessibility, lack of cataloging, or by archivists who are unwilling to assume even slight risks. But another kind of enclosure applies to interactive works. You can put them in solitary confinement. You can protect them from touch and use. You can keep them from interaction. This ages the works prematurely. This prevents them from adapting or being adapted to new users and uses and to new platforms and code. I don't think you can keep interactive works alive when they're sequestered in a sandbox. You do not need law, restrictions, or locks to enclose a work. You just have to make it inconvenient to touch, inconvenient to use. And that's often a characteristic of an aging interactive work. Its affordances are like temporary abilities that over time evolve into disabilities. There's different modalities of accessing different material enclosed by aging frameworks. One, of course, has been to just take a picture of it. This is what art books do. And, you know, even if they don't, if they fall short of reaching artists' intentions, they have a purpose. Google Books took pictures of millions of books. And in fact, taking pictures of objects is quite often the way that we understand digitizing today, which has evolved from slow scanning to more rapid photography to 3D scanning to LiDAR. Think of the Google Street View and the Uber cars topped with rapidly rotating panoptic eyes and now scanning non-visible spectra or looking into solid objects. We're getting better at representing a certain exactitude, and each new kind of capture convinces us that it is what digitization should be, convinces us that it is corralling in some elusive truth of objects and events. But all by itself, the moving image archival community is not going to build the tech infrastructure for digital preservation. The problems are spread across too many domains. Even the studios are trapped in imperfect solutions. Preservation is like borrowing at a variable interest rate. There's no certainty. And the technical issues won't be the hardest to solve. The cultural and curatorial issues are much harder. Because on a broader level, co-creation resists enclosure. It is by its very nature unruly. It resists being crammed into archival containers. As I'll get into shortly, it also may be sensitive. It is increasingly distributed across platforms and services. As makers, we may choose to serve our viewers by tactical collaborations with archival unfriendly services. This issue may be harder and harder to solve.
We are at the brink of capturing and recording every single human interaction. As we learn to navigate this new complex landscape of digital artifacts, we have come to terms with its overwhelming and ephemeral nature. Professor Prillinger says that what we do with cultural and curatorial issues are much more important than the act of archiving itself. Thank you for listening to this Five Perspectives.
De voir son groupe préféré sur scène. Il y a pensé toute la semaine. Il a acheté son billet, il a mis son chandail du groupe, il s'est rendu à la salle de spectacle. Il n'a pas pu rentrer dans la salle de spectacle. Il a rangé son chandail du groupe, il a acheté son billet et il y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur, faites-vous vacciner. En septembre, le passeport vaccinal sera exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
me and they by my side. She do anything, make any sacrifice. Then you open it, I do your right. Put pressure on the sitting all night. Can I give it up?
Preliminaries already on your own. You know the boss of my system, I'm on, and you never